This program is sponsored in part by the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatments, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Epilepsy Foundation Florida leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com/Florida to find out how to get involved today. Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolios strive to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a neurologist that practices at the Mayo Clinic here in Jacksonville. This is What's Health Got to Do With It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. And just ahead, we'll examine healthcare wearables, which can now track everything from your heart rate to the distance you ran to the amount of sleep you got. Then implanted devices for your brain, the next frontier for wearables, which connects your brain to a device to track health issues like seizures. And later, wearable health doesn't have to be complicated. It can be just some tape. In fact, some athletes swear by it. But first this hour, wearables for your health. According to the Association of the American Medical Colleges, there will be an estimated shortage of between 37,800 and 124,000 primary and specialty care physicians by 2034. With significantly fewer doctors, rising healthcare costs, and an increase in patients with chronic diseases like diabetes and asthma, utilizing technology to monitor and treat patients more efficiently and effectively has never been more urgent. Think of those old Star Trek episodes when Dr. McCoy waved his tricorder device over the character and he had an immediate diagnosis. Now fast forward to 2021, and that is where healthcare wearables comes in. Wearables are smart electronic devices that are worn close to and or on the surface of the skin where they detect, analyze, and transmit information concerning body signals such as vital signs like your pulse, oxygen, and blood pressure, which in some cases immediately alerts the person wearing the technology to take action when necessary. Wearable devices are a new frontier for healthcare, providing continuous physiological 24-hour monitoring and early detection of chronic conditions and acute disease onset based on you and your risk factors. Wearable devices can allow doctors, nurses, and other clinical staff to monitor patients, whether they're in the hospital or at home. With patients' physiology remotely measured in real time, hospitals can free up beds, doctors can keep watch on patients' vitals regardless of location, and greater efficiency is gained. Healthcare wearables are also big business. In fact, the global wearable medical device market is expected to grow from $8.35 billion in 2020 to $10.28 billion in 2021 at a compound annual growth rate of 23.1%. So what do medical wearables look like? Think watches, wristbands, clothing, earwear, and other devices for the applications like remote patient monitoring, sports and fitness designed for lifestyle disease management like weight control, physical activity monitoring, and even whether or not you're in pain. So do you have a Fitbit, Apple Watch, Samsung Watch, or an app monitoring your breathing or movement on your phone? Have you wondered how they work, or whether there's an easier way to monitor your health? If so, then this show is tailor-made for you. Joining us now to understand wearables better is Dr. Charles Audincourt with Yale Medicine. He recently co-authored a study entitled The Emerging Clinical Roles of Wearables, Factors for Successful Implementation in Healthcare. So Dr. Audincourt, it is a pleasure to have you and welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, why don't you start us off by telling us about that paper and research you just recently had published. Can you summarize for us what was what you found within that paper?
Absolutely. So, you know, just like you had just mentioned with your introduction, wearables represent a rapidly growing aspect of our current healthcare system. If anything, you know, our current experience with the COVID pandemic has actually highlighted the very important role of providing services through telehealth, and then also highlighted a very critical aspect of wearables being used by healthcare providers and physicians to remotely provide health services to patients. So one of the things that our research group was very interested in looking at was, how do you identify features that would help various health systems that are interested in implementing wearables in their health system? What are the key features that they need to pay attention to? So number one is that you need to have a clearly defined health problem that you want to look at. So, you know, in your example, you were talking about things like seizures, blood pressure control, diabetes, etc. Right. So you need to have identified health conditions that will be amenable to utilization of wearables. So that was the first feature that we identified. The other thing is to have a well set up technological support system, because, you know, as you know, sometimes we have glitches. Anybody who's done like Zoom calls, you know, these days, you know, all of a sudden something happens, the video goes off, right? So you need to have that well-established technology support system. And the other thing is to find a way to integrate this into the electronic health system. You know, majority of health systems across the United States currently have some form of electronic health platform, whether it's Cerner or Epic, PowerChart, etc. And in order to be able to utilize the wearables in your health system, there has to be a seamless connection with the existing infrastructure in terms of the electronic health system. Otherwise, it makes it quite difficult in terms of collecting or collating the data in one place and making it accessible to both the patient and the physician or health provider. The other thing that we found, to be very important is to have local clinician champions. In other words, people who are well-trained in the health system, who understand some of the intricacies of these devices. Understood. And would be like a local advocate or voice, you know, to helping implement some of these health wearable systems. And then the other important part, which I think is applicable across board, is having well-established payment and reimbursement models, because as you know, in healthcare, you know,
yes,
cost is
the business
very
side of it. Yes,
it's a very important aspect. You know, a very good example this year, for example, the HHS, you know, modified the reimbursements for video visits. Right, initially when COVID started, you were not getting full reimbursement for it, but now because of some, you know, the difficulty of in accessing remote areas in rural areas and things like that, I think it was very preemptive. It was very helpful that, you know, they modified the reimbursement rules. And so I think that, you know, having a very good and well-established reimbursement model in terms of how people get paid to do this kind of work is very vital, you know, and these are the key features that we identified in our health system. So we really wanted to create a template for other health systems that were interested in implementing this in their systems.
So I get it. So at the end, you talk not only about the technology and bringing us these wearables, but how do you successfully keep it going by business models that work? Let me ask this question. So are most wearables that are coming out, are they pretty effective and accurate in what they set out to do, or are some just not ready for prime time?
I'm glad you asked that question. So if you just do a simple Google search, you're going to come across several examples of existing wearable devices. One of the areas of research that we are currently looking at is trying to standardize the different measures that are being collected by these devices. You know, there's a saying in technology, I think, garbage in, garbage out. If you don't have a very well organized input system for these devices, the output that you're going to get from them is going to be complete garbage. And it's going to be really hard to make sense of any of the data. So one of the areas that we are looking at right now in terms of research is to define, based on disease phenotypes, specific digital, what we call digital markers, you know, specific features that are unique for each disease condition. So what do I mean by that? So for example, if you have, let's say, somebody who has knee osteoarthritis, right? And they have severe pain from knee osteoarthritis. And because of that, the way they walk is affected. You know, maybe you're using a wearable, whether it's the Apple smartwatch or let's say a Fitbit or a Samsung Galaxy watch,
right?
Automatically you can collect step data, right?
Yeah.
But that step data, it's so global, it's not very well defined, and it's hard to make sense of how different is that step data from somebody else who has a different condition. Right. So what we are doing right now, we are looking at, in my lab, we have, you know, a research study going on looking at specifically patients with knee osteoarthritis to try to define if there are unique gait patterns that are specific to knee osteoarthritis and try to define what those gait patterns are. So that if there's a different provider, let's say across the country, somewhere in California, who has similar patients, once we standardize what those features are, we can actually start to track them in a longitudinal fashion.
You're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and today we're discussing healthcare wearables. And we want to hear from you. If you have a question about this topic or an idea for others, tweet me at Jay Servin, email us at health@wjct.org, or leave us a message at 904-358-6362. Dr. Odenkor, I want to get to some listener questions that we got from social media. And so the first one is Cynthia from Jacksonville, and she wrote, "I have a meditation app that alerts me when I seem stressed and reminds me to breathe deeply. The problem is that the reminder makes me feel more anxious because it has reminded me of the problem. My question is whether you think having this much information about me is good for me psychologically."
Yes, thank you very much. That's a very, very insightful question. You know, and this is actually one of the things that we looked at in our paper that was just published. Because, you know, initially when these wearables started coming out, one of the pushback was the very exact issue that you just raised, which is that maybe, you know, folks are going to have, or patients are going to have, information overload, and they're going to be overwhelmed by the data. And so one of the things that we found has been useful is to try to create some kind of gamification component of it, mm-hmm. and having some kind of reward system. So yes, on the flip side, yeah, I mean, it's possible to be overwhelmed and be anxious, but then on the other side, let's say maybe you get 5 stars. So you get some kind of reward system, right? For meaning taking deeper breath or breathing more easy, and find a way to make it fun. You know, that is one way that you can sort of counteract the negative aspect of having too much information. The other aspect is to have health providers, physicians, nurses, etc., be at the other end of this data output. So instead of just the information going just to you, you have some of this information also going to your doctor, who can either help reinforce good behaviors or try to discourage bad behavior.
Wow.
You know, and so that is one way to sort of go, you know, overcome this whole aspect of information overload and, you know, the negative, possible negative aspect of having the wearable devices.
Let me kind of delve deeper into this. So like along the lines of this, of the caller, the social media question, what should we be doing when a wearable tells us that hey, you have a problem. Should we be pushing the button to silence that, take off the watch or the fabric? I mean, what should we be doing?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, this gets at the issue of behavior fatigue. It's a phenomenon where, you know, individuals get exposed to information over and over again, and after a while, your brain sort of gets sick of seeing it and then either ignores it or becomes concerned about it. One advice that we found helpful in our own practice for patients is to have daily goals. And so regardless of what type of wearable you're using or what you're using it for, is to personally just have your own set goals, and also to, you know, be kind to yourself. Because there are times that you are just not going to be able to achieve the goals you have set, and right. That's okay, you know. But just to remember that so long as you are moving in the general direction of what your goals are, that's really what matters, you know. And not to really worry too much about, you know, if you get feedback from the device. You do have the option to either, well, okay, I'm going to remind myself to take a deeper breath, or I'm just going to ignore this particular signal that I've gotten. Got right. It. And so at the end of the day, you should see this as a tool that is there to help you and not really something that is supposed to make you feel overwhelmed or feel like you're not really, you know, meeting your personal goals and whatnot. And so one advice, I think, if nothing at all, just setting goals for yourself and being kind to yourself if you don't meet those goals,
which is huge. Which is huge advice for all of us all the time. I have two listener questions that are really pertaining to security, and so I'm going to kind of go through each of them, and then maybe we can combine this. So the first one is from Paul from the Beaches, who wanted to know who's actually seeing and using the data generated from these devices. Is it just me, or is it Apple, Google, and Samsung seeing things about me? What about privacy? And then a similar question from Bethany from Pontevedra. Are these devices subject to hacking or malware that could actually hurt you if you're wearing them? So what about privacy and then this hacking malware issue?
Yes. This is really the big elephant in the room, you know, whenever yes. we talk about any kind of technology, right? You know, whether it's our own computers, your cell phones, you know, self-driving cars and whatnot, security is always an issue. In fact, it's really funny you just bring this up. Just yesterday, I was watching this TV episode. It's called I think it's 911. And there was a caller who called in, and, you know, the system at the airport actually had been hacked into, and it was this complete chaos. But I think that this is something that we are all wrestling with, because, you know, systems can always be hacked. And there are people who are out there, you know, they are good hackers, they are bad hackers. You know, that's something that everybody just has to be wary of. You know, all our wearable devices do have security settings on them. And, you know, the best you can do is to just make sure that, you know, those system updates and software updates are up to date on your wearable device. But, you know, in terms of being like, hacker proof, we don't really have any system right now that are like hack proof, right? And then the other thing is, in terms of who sees your data, unfortunately, you know, every time we have these smart devices, you know, sometimes you have these user agreements, and most of us, even myself, we just skip through it, right? And we just go
on. I do it all the time. I hate to say it.
Because it's so lengthy. Who has the time to read it, right?
Right.
And we just sign it away and we agree to the terms and conditions, you know. And unfortunately, I think they haven't found a more efficient way to alert consumers to some of the potential risk of, you know, taking on these devices. You know, I don't really have a very like clear answer. I don't think anybody has a clear answer, actually, honestly, in terms of the security of these devices. So that's always a potential risk, you know, when we sign on to use these devices. And then I think what was the other component of this?
The other question was malware and
malware and
hacking.
Yeah. So I think for malware, there are anti-viral anti-malware
software that you absolutely have to make sure that you've installed on any of your smart devices. And they usually have security updates quite frequently. And so one way to make sure that your device is secure and safe is to make sure that the malware counter software is always up to date on your device. And just being very prudent and cautious about what information you have out there that you are releasing to the public, right?
Right.
And even with social media, it's the same. Everybody has a social media account. You have the option to make your settings private or public, right? And so some of the responsibility really ends up in the hands of the individual user.
Dr. Odenkirk, I think we're going to leave it there. All I can say that your insights are so incredibly valued. This has been wonderfully helpful. We've been talking with Dr. Charles Odenkirk at Yale Medicine, and we want to thank him for his insights. He recently published an article entitled The Emerging Clinical Role of Wearables, Factors for Successful Implementation in Healthcare. Thank you, Dr. Odenkirk, for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. A pleasure to be here.
It's been our pleasure as well. And up next, we'll speak with a patient who has had an implanted healthcare wearable. We'll be right back.
When you look at an object, the image of that object appears upside down on your retina. However, your brain automatically corrects for this, allowing you to perceive the object right side up.
Welcome back. This is What's Health Got to Do with It. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a local neurologist here in Jacksonville, and thanks for listening. Do you remember those 1970s TV shows, The Bionic Man or Bionic Woman? Have you marveled at Iron Man with his self-created electromagnet implanted in his chest to allow him to keep living? Well, implanted medical devices are no longer just science fiction. In fact, almost 10% of the American population has had an implantable medical device for a health issue. Most of these, like pacemakers or stents, have to do with heart issues. The FDA defines a device as implantable if it's either partly or totally introduced, surgically or medically, into the human body and is intended to remain there after the procedure. Now, starting with the first heart pacemaker implant in 1958, there has been an explosion of implanted devices available with advances that seem more like science fiction than science fact. Now we have brain implants ready to tackle various brain diseases, from deep brain stimulation for tremors to management of epileptic seizures. There are currently lots of options available, with even more in development. Joining us to share his personal experience with a device for epilepsy called responsive neurostimulation for his seizures is Mr. Michael McKenna, who lives with an implanted device. So, Mike, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you, Dr. Servin, and thank you for inviting me and letting me share my experiences.
It's a pleasure. So, Michael, for our listeners, give us a sense of your medical journey and how you came to be implanted with this device.
So, over 25 years ago, I was diagnosed with epilepsy, and very early on, 25 years ago, we really didn't have medical devices for me. So I was taking medications for many years. I had a ICD pacemaker implanted for abnormal heart rhythms because of my epilepsy. And then I also had a right shoulder prosthetic implanted because of my injuries, because of my seizures. I then went into a neuromodulation device called VNS, and we tried that for about 2.5 years. And then eventually we transitioned into the RNS system research study. And I went into that, not really understanding what the RNS system could do for me, but it was a new medical device, and I decided to take the chance and see what it could do.
Michael, can you explain to everyone out there what exactly is this device you have implanted? Did you need an operation to put it in?
I did. I had to have a procedure in order to figure out where my seizures were coming from in my brain. And so my doctors were able to find the seizure address, the focus of my seizures, because my doctors were able to determine that I had focal epilepsy, which is an indication for the RNS system. So it was a surgery where they placed the RNS device within my skull, and then the electrical leads that come off of the device were placed over the areas where my seizures were coming from, which for me were my temporal lobes.
So you literally have a device that is hooked directly into the to the lobes of your brain.
Yeah, and you know it was like you mentioned, science fiction when it was being presented to me, and I thought it was really cool. You know, like I would be the bionic man. You know, I think I was asking my doctors, you know, could I get Wi-Fi on this thing? Because it was really cool. And so living with it has been really insightful for me. I learned so much about my epilepsy from this device.
Well, let me ask you, like, just on the practical logistics part, were you in the hospital for a long time? Were there any complications?
I was in the hospital for about two nights surgery. Yep, that was it. In fact, to give some perspective, I had my RNS device put in the first week and a half of me starting college. And then within 2 weeks after surgery, I was back at college, back in the classroom, taking my classes.
Wow. Wow. So to give a sense of what life is like with an implanted device to your brain, do you feel anything? Does it hurt? Was it hard to get used to?
So when I went into it, I didn't know what to expect, you know, because this was a research study. I didn't know, would I feel this? Would people be able to see that I have a device? And no one's been able to see that I have anything in my head. I can't feel when that device is going off. So I just live a normal life with my device in the background, just always there, monitoring, looking for seizure activity, responding with stimulation when needed. And those are the things that I learned over time. Was with the RNS data, I was having a lot of seizure activity that I wasn't even aware of every day. And that's where it was really insightful in starting to understand and remove the mystery about my seizures.
First of all, has it worked?
It has. So it took time in the beginning because it is personalized to me. You know, the RNS device, the stimulation settings over time were adjusted to what we call my seizure fingerprints, like what my seizures look like. And my doctors were able to adjust my stimulation parameters to me. We also learned from the data that was collected, there were actually things in my life that I was doing every day that were actually seizure triggers. For example, down in Phoenix, Arizona, anytime I got to over 110 degrees out, we ended up learning through me keeping a seizure diary that heat stress was a seizure trigger for me.
Wow.
We correlated it with the RNS data. So that enabled me to adapt my daily activities to help remove that trigger, which lowered my seizure sensitivity.
So you bring me to the question. So what do the doctors do? Do they just track the seizure activity with as a result of the device? Do you track it? How does that work?
Yeah. So with the RNS system, there's a RNS laptop computer. And with that laptop, I'm able to download my data from my head to that laptop, upload it to a computer server over the internet, and then my doctors are able to log into that computer server to see how I'm doing. So my doctors, there's a follow-up schedule every 3 months with my doctors, and they're able to look at my prior months of activity and come up with any stimulation changes that they might want to make at my upcoming appointment.
Michael, in our last moment or so, can you give our listeners, our audience, what take-home message would you want to offer folks about your experience and living literally with an implanted device in your brain?
So I would say if you're living with uncontrolled seizures, definitely have a conversation with your doctors about looking at other treatment options. You know, I was really scared thinking, oh, I'm going to have this device in my head. You know, it's going to change me. But having a conversation with my doctors, you know, really helped ease the worry and concerns I had very early on, helped set expectations up front. You know, and then worked together with my, you know, I worked together with my doctors over time, and we were able to manage my medications using the RNS data, got me off of a lot of medications. I was able to kind of see that my seizure worry started going down, and that really had a huge effect on my quality of life, like improvements. And so I would say, if you're not happy where you are, you know, with your epilepsy treatment, definitely have a conversation with your doctor, have a conversation with the epilepsy specialist and research, talk about treatment options.
Michael, I want to thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. We are all so delighted to hear that you're doing beautifully, and we love the insights that you have for the audience. So we really appreciate you talking to us today.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Servin. And I really appreciate being able to share my experiences and that it might help someone else out there.
We've been talking to Mr. Michael McKenna. He is a patient who's living with an implanted device right to his brain. And we appreciated his input, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. For the 3.4 million people living with epilepsy in the United States, and more than 100,000 of whom are Floridians, medications can help control their seizures most of the time. But some suffer unpleasant side effects from the drugs, and a few remain at risk of death. It is that chance for potential death from a seizure that occurs at night, when no one is watching, that frightens both patients and their doctors. However, researchers at the Johns Hopkins University are helping those with the neurological condition by collecting information about their seizures through their watches, specifically their Apple Watches. They have an app on the watch that can detect, predict, and even alert family members when someone is having a seizure. Now, joining us now to talk about this wearable app is Dr. Greg Kraus, a professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Dr. Kraus, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Dr. Kraus, why did you all create this app?
Well, there's a clinical need in that we were encountering several patients a year in each of our practices who are suffering from sudden unexpected death and epilepsy. So there's a real need to kind of identify seizures and notify caregivers so they can rescue these persons and try to avoid the serious risk of seizures. And about 5 years ago, the Apple Watch came out, and it's a little mini computer on the arm, and it allows a nice interface where you can actually provide disease support through an app and also use sensors, heart rate and movement sensors, which are quite accurate in the Apple Watch, to develop a method for detecting tonic-clonic seizures and then messaging caregivers. And so we spent about the last 5 years actually collecting data in a pool of subjects all over the country who signed up to donate watch data during seizures. And we developed a seizure detector and kind of a disease support app called EpiWatch.
So explain in general, what is that app doing, and making it as simple as you can for someone like me, and how does it work?
Yeah, it turns out convulsive seizures, tonic-clonic seizures, have very distinctive movements associated with them, and they're not exactly what you think. So when people have tonic-clonic seizures, those are the major convulsions, which are called grand mal seizures. people stiffen and they make small vibration movements, and then they get jerks called the conic phase of the seizure. And an accurate accelerometer, a movement measurement device on the watch, can identify these tonic vibration movements and these conic jerks. And coupled with heart rate measurements, where heart rate goes up during these major seizures, we can very accurately identify convulsive seizures.
That's amazing. So literally that Apple Watch, it's detecting a brain condition through the signals that it gets just by the way this device is engineered without being surgically implanted.
That's right. There's a big interest in using mobile devices for digital health approaches. So there's quite a few different areas that are being explored to use smartwatches, smartphones, and specialized devices to kind of help support various disease states like cardiologic disease, where people can have problems with rhythms, deoxygenation conditions like syncope. There's a big interest in looking at, you know, movements and exercise and their role in disease states. So it's kind of a natural where you have a watch on an arm that's just a normal part of our life, to use this watch in people who have uncontrolled seizures to identify seizures and get them help if they're ever having trouble with their seizures.
That is amazing. Now, what kind of results are you seeing with the app?
It's very accurate, and what we've really focused on is trying to remove false positives. I mean, if a person has a major seizure, say they have uncontrolled epilepsy and they have a major seizure once a month, you don't want this detector messaging a caregiver to come rescue them every other day. And so we worked a lot on identifying normal movements and accurately identifying tonic-clonic seizures. Now, it turns out most people who have problems following tonic-clonic seizures, it's not occurring. Their problems aren't usually during the seizure itself. It's the end of the seizure. So what happens following a major convulsion, people have about 60 seconds where the EEG goes flat and people are actually paralyzed. They're just limp. And during that time, they have this snoring, abnormal breathing pattern called stertor. And so their pharynx kind of collapses.
It's a throat.
So the time, yep. Okay. And so people who have major convulsions, who have sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, it tends to occur immediately following the seizure during a period where their brain waves are flat for about a minute and they're just paralyzed and they're not able to normally ventilate. And so the biggest risk period for SUDEP is people sleeping face down, prone, in a prone position.
Okay.
So if you have a convulsion at night and you happen to be face down, there's a major risk for the SUDEP. And the watch is a really good way to kind of monitor for that problem and then message a family member or caregiver if they have a seizure in that situation.
The technology is just amazing when I hear that's just on a normal watch. Let me play the other side of this equation. How does it handle data privacy? That seems to come up a lot with the app. Who gets to see this information besides the person wearing it?
Well, in the research stage, we actually have an electronic consent where we are actually allowed to save their seizure data. And there's a whole health profile that's part of the Apple Health System, and people can select and deselect which information they want to provide. Some people actually don't want to provide their age, but we collect basic demographics so we can provide technical support. Their data, though, is stored on a highly engineered server system that is quite secure. And if they are participating in a research project, we only save their data if they've consented to this. Now, people using it privately would have control over their data without any research use of their data unless they had consented to this.
Dr. Krause, if someone's listening out there and you hear we've been talking about prevention of death from a relatively common condition, something like seizures, where can someone interested get more information on the app or on any of this in general?
Well, the Epilepsy Foundation of America on their website has a section about seizure detection, and they're actually especially interested in seizure prediction, which is more of a probabilistic technique. We've been more focused on detection of major convulsions and having measurements of people's recovery following the seizure with little quizzes that we send to them on the app, and then getting a caregiver to help them. One thing we've focused on recently in our seizure unit is actually how to optimize seizure first aid, like what techniques people can use following a convulsion to help the person recover faster. And so we're testing the standard approach, which is turn them on their side, stimulate them, kind of protect their head from injury. And if they're in the hospital, sometimes we can deliver oxygen. But that's a standard first aid approach for someone who's had a major convulsion. We're adding a technique of neck tilt, chin lift, which actually opens up their airways, and it appears to allow them to recover faster.
That is wonderful words of advice, and I love the seizure first aid, because I think that'll come in very handy. Dr. Krause, I want to thank you for joining us and talking about the remarkable technology that watch has and possesses, and we really appreciate your insights today.
Yeah, thanks very much. We're in the middle of an FDA clearance study now, so this will be released in probably 6 months or so.
That is fantastic. We'll look forward to it. We've been talking to Dr. Greg Krause. He is a professor of neurology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. We've been talking to him about a very cool wearable app for your iPhone. Thanks so much.
Yep.
And we'll be right back.
The human hand contains 3 major nerves, 2 major arteries, and 27 different bones. More of the body is devoted to controlling the hands than any other part of the body.
Welcome back. Not all wearables have to involve a complex circuit board or mind-blowing technology. Sometimes the answer can be relatively simple. In fact, it can be as simple as tape. Take a kinesiology tape, or KT tape, which is used by runners, athletes, and physical therapists. Kinesiology tape is quite literally tape that you, or really your physical therapist, applies to your muscles. It was developed in the 1970s by Kenzo Case, a chiropractic doctor in Japan, who wanted to create something that mimicked the elasticity of human skin instead of using stiff medical tape. While it was used widely by professional athletes, physical therapists, and trainers alike, it didn't really go mainstream until the 2008 Summer Olympics, when volleyball player Kerry Walsh wore KT tape on her shoulder and subsequently won the gold medal. Now kinesiology tape is ubiquitous in the athletic world. Joining us to talk about KT tape is Dr. Kevin McPherson, a clinical lecturer and assistant director of clinical education at the University of Florida's Department of Physical Therapy. Dr. McPherson, it is a pleasure to have you on our program today.
Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to the chat.
Well, explain for us, how is KT tape different from other medical tape?
So you described a fair amount of the biggest difference. It does allow for flexibility. It allows for movement of the skin, but it also allows for tensioning of the skin, which happens to be part of the mechanism that we believe is associated with how it works just in general. Which is very different from a lot of your standard tapes, where there's not a lot of give. It's almost restrictive, or the skin gets used to it after a while. So there's some complex stuff behind it, but we don't need to dive that far into it.
Well, kind of keeping it as simple as we can, how does it work?
So we used to believe that tape had some sort of catching property. It would grab onto the bone that it was above, or the muscles that it was above. And then they did some studies, and the study said, no, really, there's not much that changes in the way that the joints are stabilized from this tape or whatnot. So we had to jump back. We had to figure out what was going on. And lo and behold, the current best guess is that your skin has tons of receptors in it.
Okay.
And these are just little sensors. They're just like what you have in your phone, what you have in your different wearable devices, but your skin has it. And the belief is that this tape because it flexes, because it moves, it gives you extra stimulus. It kind of says, hey, pay more attention to this area, which then your body is able to take that extra information and use that to help you move with less pain.
That's fascinating. And it sounds so simplistic, at least in the mindset of how it looks. Aside from athletics and all of the hoopla that it's gotten, what conditions is it probably most useful for?
So this is one of the things that is a little bit more challenging, because it's not necessarily just conditions, but it's also the patients. There are individuals who can look the exact same. You put the tape on and one, it works fabulously for the other one, not so much. So there's a little bit of nuance to it, but in general, we try to use the same process with that intervention as we use for other ones. So let's see what your movement strategy is and how that is affecting your symptoms, your ability to play volleyball, whatever it is, and then apply the tape. And from there, see if it makes a positive impact on the person's movement.
How well do you think it works?
How
well do you think it works in your mindset?
For the correct patient, it works amazingly well. It's actually very surprising how quickly it can work. For the wrong patient, it doesn't do anything, which is nice to have minimal side effects. But real quickly, population-wise, it is branching out. We're starting to see this used in different types of movement disorders that are more associated with neurological diseases. We're also seeing some practitioners using it for lymphedema and helping decrease some of the swelling that's associated with it. So. The science, like you mentioned, is a little bit behind because it really caught on back in 2008. So we're really starting to catch up more and more as we learn more through the research.
That's fascinating about all its uses. I have a listener question. Holly in Riverside asks and makes a comment. I developed a rash after 6 days of wearing the tape, but only once and only in one spot. Not everywhere the tape was applied. I never thought I'd have other issues, and I used it off and on for years. Any thoughts if I run into this, and anything to try in the future?
So the tape in general, really the longest you want to have anything in contact with your skin, if you can get away with it, is only about 3 to 4 days. So sometimes it's just a matter of having that on for a long period of time without giving the skin a chance to relax from the tension from the tape. Additionally, if you don't really clean the skin well prior to putting the tape on, that can also trap different substances that may aggravate the skin. So in general, I would recommend that you use the KT tape to help you move for whatever that activity is, and then ideally pull it off, let the air get to the skin, and that should limit how many times that you get rashes and such.
Can another listener comment? Can it be useful for stabilizing joints in conditions like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome?
Ooh, that's a really good question. So one of the issues that we have with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which for those who aren't familiar, is a syndrome that just allows the person's skin, their ligaments, their joints to just have more mobility or more stretch to them than the average person, and also potentially leads to excessive wear and tear. Now, like I said earlier, the KT tape can stimulate some of the skin receptors, and it may improve the way that the muscles function and maybe help stabilize that joint. But if you put a lot of load on the tissues do have to take that. When I say tissues, this is ligaments. The muscles, the joints, etc., they do have to take that load. So if you're looking for it to stabilize you against really high velocity, lots of load, I would not trust the tape. But if you're looking for it to help you out with functional activities where there's predictable amounts of force going through your joints, I think it would help out.
Let me kind of play the devil's advocate. There's been one large review that seemed to have some low evidence to support the use of KT tape, and some critics even wonder if the benefits are simply a placebo effect. What are your thoughts on that?
That is also one of the knocks we have right now on it. So I think there's two different things to keep in mind. I think that we have not done a good job of determining what group of individuals best benefit from the tape. As such, you have what we use in the research world as a very heterogeneous population. You got a lot of people who are getting the tape, and not a lot of them are really the ones that are key for it. So it washes out the research findings. Now, the other side of that is placebo is a huge factor on many different treatment strategies. In fact, there are quite a few orthopedic surgeries that now appear to have nothing more than a placebo effect to them. But I caution people to think that placebo is this negative, bad term, because it's really utilizing your own body's nervous system and the chemicals within it, which if you look at a lot of the major drugs like pain relievers, your body has a variant already in it. It's only that sometimes you need a little extra, which is where medications or sometimes placebos can help.
That's a very fair point and actually a great topic for another discussion even. In our final moment, what take-home message do you have for our listeners with regards to KT tape?
The take-home message is that if you're moving and you're having pain and you want to get a little bit of extra support, this is a very minimal cost, potentially high benefit intervention. However, it should be used in the short term. You should be also looking at how to improve your body strength or range of motion so that you don't need the tape. It shouldn't be used for long terms.
That is wonderful words of advice. We've been talking to Dr. Kevin McPherson, a clinical lecturer and assistant director of clinical education at the University of Florida's Department of Physical Therapy. Dr. McPherson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
It's been wonderful. Well, that's our program for today. If you missed anything, you can catch the rebroadcast tomorrow at 9 p.m. or listen to the full program at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests and social media participants. Our senior producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our associate producer is Catherine Hobbs. Have questions or comments or a medical question for a future show on what's health got to do with it, call us at 904-358-6362 or tweet me at Jay Servin. Send an email to health@wjct.org. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and keep in touch.
This program is sponsored in part by the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatments, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Epilepsy Foundation Florida leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com/Florida to find out how to get involved today.